Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for April 2012. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. My guest for this podcast is Cynthia Lopez Beveridge. Cynthia is an attorney and is the Director of Disputes, Litigation, and Licensing for ST Ericsson. ST Ericsson is a global wireless platform and semiconductor supplier to four of the top five mobile handset manufacturers and is in the business of, among other things, inventing things. Cynthia wrote a paper entitled Surviving in a Secondary Patent Marketplace and presented it at the 2012 midwinter meeting of the AIPLA. In her paper, she describes the murky market of patent assignments and licenses, which is currently having a noticeable effect in the telecommunications marketplace. I spoke with Cynthia from her office in Santa Clara, California. Hello, Cynthia.
Hi, Don. This is Cynthia. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. In your paper, you talked about the secondary patent marketplace, and I wonder from an in-house counsel's perspective, could you explain what you're talking about by the secondary patent marketplace?
Sure. And what I mean by secondary is that it's kind of a marketplace that kind of has risen up out of just the existence of patents. The patent marketplace, I guess, would be more closer to a description where it's patents that are being applied for, prosecuted for, and used by companies and paid for by companies, but they're not selling them. This is something new that has just recently started where companies are actually selling their patents and also licensing them. And though that has not been something entirely new, now we're having new entities come in who don't even actually make a product or do the R&D, and they are starting to use those patents that they've purchased on that secondary marketplace to also try to gain some revenue from the patents through licensing efforts.
And
it's a new market.
I hadn't realized until looking at your paper the size of the market. You say it in 2011, it had grown to $150 billion in licensing royalties, $1.2
yes.
billion in patent sales. Just absolutely huge.
Yeah, and this is something that, I mean, that quote, the 2011, the number there, the $150 billion in revenues, that actually started, that came from 2008, and the estimate was that it was going to continue to grow at 25 to 35% per year. So, yes, it is a massive, massive marketplace, and that includes both, of course, licensing fees and sales, because the sales that have been generated is about $1.2 billion in patent sales, and then about the additional there is from actual licensing efforts, from licensing of patents.
In your paper, you talk about some of the challenges for an operating company that wants to monetize its patents. And one of the points you state is that the best defense is a good offense, is that a company should really be creating its own high-value portfolio of patents. Could you explain that process?
Sure. It's a very difficult process, and the first thing a company has to do to even be able to have a good defense, which is to have a really good patent portfolio that it can use both to defend itself, and sometimes it might need to monetize those patents to defend itself to cover the costs of patent assertion entities or non-practicing entities that are coming after it. But it is a very murky marketplace. It's a crowded marketplace in the sense that there are a lot of players. And I can explain those players if you'd like me to.
Sure.
Because there are quite a few.
Sure. I think you mentioned about 10 or 15 of them. Maybe if you can give us sort of the biggest, broadest categories.
Yeah. The broadest categories, if you think about it, you've got patents and there's people that are wanting to buy them. There's people that are wanting to sell them. And there's people that are wanting to facilitate that sale. So if you just put it in three broad categories, you've got sellers, you've got buyers, and you've got facilitators. The sellers are often either inventors, patent assertion entities sometimes, and even operating companies who have patents that they are no longer needing to use to defend their products, and they don't want to really use their patents to license them to other companies. So they'll often sell off some of their patents. The buyers are usually composed of defensive patent aggregators like an RPX who's trying to buy the patents to keep them off the marketplace. And then, of course, you've got the patent assertion entities and sometimes operating companies. They also want to be buyers of those patents. And then the facilitators is where it gets really kind of complex. You get financing companies who sometimes want to give their money to a company who's wanting to buy patents and then license them and make some money off of them. You've got litigation finance firms, you've got clearing houses, you've got auctioneers, you've got patent attorneys even who have to be there to actually help you understand the patent, what it covers, what you can license. You've got patent valuation experts, licensing agents, you need market research, you've got brokers. So there's a long list of different entities that are actually there to facilitate both the purchase, the evaluation, the valuation, and the actual licensing of patents or the sale of patents.
One of the points you raise in your paper is the fact that the landscape keeps changing. And for someone who's trying to figure out what the boundaries are of the patent landscape, it changes, if not weekly, then daily. The analogy that came to mind for me was it's like a land covered with landmines that keep getting deployed. So you may clean up some today, but when you get up tomorrow to do it again, there's more out there. Could you explain a little more sort of the murky market and how you demurky the market?
The market is murky because patents, though their sale may be recorded or their transfer, you know, their assignment is what the terminology that is used for patents, though assignments may be recorded at the PTO, the licensing of those patents does not have to be recorded anywhere. If you're thinking about buying a patent and you want to go back on the chain of title search, for example, like you're going to buy a piece of property, some land, you can go to a title company and find out with pretty good certainty who all has owned it. With a patent, it's not that way necessarily when it comes to licensing. Though you may be able to know who actually owned it before you, you may not know what rights have actually already been divested. There may be an exclusive license out there you don't know about. There may be a non-exclusive license out there that is actually encumbering that patent. And though you may find out what some of those are, you may not know what all of them are because sometimes patents get licensed and there's no way of finding out. It's a confidential agreement and nobody will tell you anything about it because many companies are really nervous about other companies knowing what they're actually doing when it comes to licensing. So there's sometimes some anonymity that's built in as well as confidentiality when it comes to the licensing of patents. And that is an encumbrance on any patent that you might want to purchase.
In the section of your paper that deals with valuation, you had a great quote. You said, valuation isn't rocket science, it's harder. and as a retired rocket scientist, I have both take offense and appreciation for a line like that. Maybe if you could explain perhaps some of the trials and tribulations of putting a value on a patent or a patent portfolio.
Well, the first place, you know, patents are limited by their claims. But then when you take a look at those claims, I must say that I have seen some patents being asserted against other entities, and you would never have thought from reading that patent that those claims were actually directed to whatever product they're being asserted against. That's one tangent on how do you really value and evaluate a patent. Another is that it's just very, very difficult sometimes. It's the chicken or the egg thing. My patent is valuable because everybody wants to license it. Well, why does everybody want to license it? Well, you know, sometimes it's because you have a first-of-kind technology. Sometimes it's just because your patent can actually be read so broadly that it covers technology that you really never had in mind necessarily when you actually wrote the patent, because the claims are written narrowly, and so in an odd way, they're written so narrowly that they didn't actually identify the product in question. So it's hard to evaluate patents because you have to have information on the market to be able to know whether your patent is valuable. So you need both market research, and then you also need to understand exactly what the scope of your patent claims are. For a patent to be valuable, first of a kind of technology is good. You may not know that you have a group of valuable patents is another example where you have fencing patents where you can actually go and patent around a competitor's core products and make sure they cannot expand. You may look at that patent initially, one of those patents, and go, oh, it's not valuable. But once you combine them with a group of other patents, you might actually have a group that's really quite valuable. But then again, you also have to take in context not just the market, but also timing. You may have a fabulous invention, but it may be too early in time to ever make it to the market. So again, you have to look at the market. You have to look at the actual invention itself. You have to look at it in context of time. And you have to look at it in context of the market where you want to assert it. Will people actually be willing to take a license to your patent, or are you going to actually have to go file suit? That, of course, is going to lower the value of your patent, because if you have to litigate it before you can actually get money, it's not as valuable. There are a lot of things. Go ahead.
One of the tools you describe is how often a patent might be cited in other patent applications as an indicator of the fundamental nature of that particular technology. I wonder if you could describe what tools are available for doing that.
The way you can actually find, obviously, if your patent has been cited in other patents, you're going to be able to go to the PTO, and this is obviously in the United States. In other countries, you have the same kind of recording process where if somebody wants to file a patent on something where your invention is actually something on which they relied, that's going to be a citation that they're going to have to make in their own application to your patent. That is given as one of the actual ways of valuing a patent, but there is way more to it than just how many times your patent gets cited.
excuse me, you describe being pursued in a secondary patent market. In one section of your paper, you say that as of January 1st, 2011, there were some 380 non-practicing entities who had brought some 4,000 lawsuits since 1985 against 5,000 operating companies. I wonder if you could describe a little more the non-practicing entity and what the effect that they've had on the secondary patent marketplace.
I think in my paper I quoted somebody actually described non-practicing entities or patent assertion entities as being a tax on a company. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the NPEs, non-practicing entities, or patent assertion entities, all they do with their patents is they go and they approach companies and operating companies and say, hey, we have X number of patents and your products, X, Y, and Z, is actually practicing our patent, give us money. And so that makes it very expensive for an operating company, because that's why it's almost like a tax on an operating company. But I will point out that despite all the 4,000 actions, I'm not really yet aware of any company that's gone out of business because a non-practicing entity or a patent assertion entity needs its operating companies. It can't live without them, so they don't want to actually put them out of business, but they do want to make money off of their patent portfolios.
So I won't apply the description that they're leeches, not vampires.
That's probably a good description, unless they're going to turn you into a vampire too.
Okay. One of the points of frustration that you mentioned in your paper of being attacked by a non-practicing entity is, unlike an operating company, you can't counterclaim against them for using some of your technology.
Yes, and that is something that is one of the most difficult things. A lot of before the secondary marketplace ever came into existence, what operating companies would do is they'd end up getting sued or pursued by other operating companies. And what the one that was being pursued could actually do is dig into its patent portfolio and find some patents that it felt that the pursuing company was actually practicing. And so you would end up with a stalemate. You know, you don't sue me over your patents, I won't sue you over my patents. However, non-practicing entities, as their name connotes, or patent assertion entities, don't have any products. And so, or generally don't have any products. And so you can't go into your own patent portfolio if you're being pursued by an NPE or a PAE and pull out some patents and say, hey, you know, I'm going to assert these against you. They just don't have anything that you can use in your portfolio against them, because they don't have any products. So that is very frustrating.
In terms of responding to cease and desist letters from either a non-practicing entity or an operating company, one of the responses that you suggest in your paper is to examine how serious is the threat.
Yes, and you can determine how serious the threat is by actually getting to know everything that you can get to know about the patent assertion entity. Generally, the larger ones are probably going to be pretty serious. They're not going to go after you unless they are pretty sure that they've done their due diligence, which means that they've had to have studied your products and then made sure that their patents are being practiced by your products, every element of each claim. But there are some patent entities or patent assertion entities or NPEs out there that are smaller. And I have heard of companies that just kind of sort of ignore the smaller ones, and sometimes they'll go out of business before they're actually able to pursue any kind of litigation. But if you make sure you do your research, you're going to be able to find out pretty quickly. I mean, some of the bigger ones actually out there have their portfolios and web pages. On their web pages, they have their patent portfolios explaining what they do and who all has taken a license, et cetera, et cetera. And those are actually pretty easy to identify as probably pretty serious. Plus, just calling around and asking people about these companies is pretty easy to do, and you can find out pretty quickly if they're serious or not.
You mentioned that in the telecommunication area in particular, there's some special circumstances regarding patents that cover standards. And I wonder if you could explain that and what the acronym FRAND stands for.
Well, FRANS, RAND or FRAND, FRAND is for Fair and Reasonable Non-Discriminatory Licensing Terms. RAND is basically the same thing without the F, which is without the fair. So RAND stands for Reasonable and Non-Discriminatory Terms. There are a lot of standard essential patents that are out there, and when those standards are actually issued, companies generally, and each standard has to be studied, but for the most part, all of those standard essential patents, if a company owns one and that company contributed in the creation of those standards, they've agreed to actually license any of those essential, standard essential patents under FRAND or RAND terms. The problem, though, is that RAND is really kind of vague, and there have been a lot of papers written on it and a lot of litigation over it on what is actually a fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory term. And it's not always something that you can find out easily, because if you go back again to the fact that a lot of the licenses that get entered into are on confidential terms, you really don't even know what the other guy down the street or the other girl, you know, down the street even really got when it came to the license terms. Were they FRAND? Were they RAND? Did you know? Can you find that out? Probably not. So it really can be a little bit meaningless.
You mentioned that with respect to those patents that are covered by a standard, that sometimes the Federal Trade Commission would have to be involved concerning those licenses.
Well, and the thing with that is there is really no cause of action that is available to a company, an entity, an individual, if they don't feel like they're getting a FRAND or a RAND license. There's nothing out there that allows them to sue. The best a company could do is wait until it got sued for not taking a license and then try to assert some kind of patent misuse argument or try some antitrust claim, but that's just not really going to fly. The best hope is to be able to assert some kind of patent misuse, but by that point you've been sued, and really all of us always try to avoid being sued. But the FTC has on one occasion considered RAND and whether or not it was an unfair method of competition. But you're going to have to wait for the FTC to get involved in that, and that's going to be really difficult.
One of the defenses, if you were, for an attack by a non-practicing entity that you refer to is cooperation with others in terms of figuring out a way to invalidate the patent that's being asserted. And
right.
you mentioned in your paper it's a strategy that, in your mind, really isn't used often enough. And I wonder if you could, A, explain the strategy, and B, maybe explain why you think it hasn't been used enough.
The first, the strategy obviously is to have a good enough network with other companies that are in your field and even outside of your field, because sometimes patents that you would never have thought were going to be actually asserted against you end up getting asserted against you and you're trying to find prior art. So I say cooperation is a strategy that needs to be used more frequently, because the only defense against a PAE or an NPE is to invalidate their patents. And the only way you can invalidate a patent is to actually find prior art. Sure, you can do searches. You can hire companies to do searches for you, but they're only going to find what's written. They're going to find, you know, articles that have been written, papers that have been published, patents that have been, you know, filed for, but they're not necessarily going to find that product or that product or the whatever data sheet that went with the product that is sitting in some company's archive. I have found it that prior art can sometimes come out of other companies' archives, and that's something that you would never have been able to find. So if there can be a little more cooperation between companies, that would be great, to be able to pick up the phone and call in-house counsel in charge of IP at X company. Can you help me? Do you have anything that might actually be prior art to this patent that's being asserted against me by this company? That would be great. I don't think we do it enough. There are entities out there that try to combine members to put that kind of process together, but you have to pay money to join them, companies like RPX. They do a really good job, but you still have to pay money. If we could actually join together more as a team and cooperate, just company to company. It is difficult, though, because unless it's a customer or a supplier, you're not going to have a relationship already automatically built. If you have a competitor, that competitor, you may call the in-house counsel at that competing company, but that competitor may not necessarily have it as a best business strategy to help you because they're your competitor. So I think that that very much limits it, in addition to the fact that sometimes it just takes a long time to find prior art, and we all just are too busy sometimes to even have the time to call the patent department or the product development branch of your company to look into the archives and see if there's something there. But if it could be done, it would be a fabulous strategy that would be really tough to beat.
Thanks very much for these insights, Cynthia.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Good talking to you, Don.
Cynthia Lopez Beveridge is the Director of Disputes, Litigation, and Licensing for ST Erickson in Santa Clara, California. For a copy of Cynthia's paper on Surviving in a Secondary Patent Marketplace, and for information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Bereskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.